Fantastic to have you on the program. I wonder if we could start about trying to understand what degree of influence does our current work ethic actually have upon the future of human labour? Are we kind of denying ourselves greater freedom and leisure due to the value we place on work?
It looks like it. And if you look at the way that we talk to each other, we're quite likely when we meet someone new to ask what they do, which is a really innocuous question until you think about why you're doing it. And often, without thinking about it, what we're trying to do is to work out where people fit into our mental models. You know, there's no doubt that we've got a lot of potential with all the things that are going on at the moment to make life really quite amazing for just about everybody on the planet if we put our mind to it. But we do seem determined sometimes to put ourselves back into boxes where we define our value by the amount of money we make, the cars we drive, the houses we live in, the food we eat. And all of those basically require us to go off and work very, very hard, despite the fact that compared to where we were 100 years ago, we don't actually need to work that hard at all.
That's interesting. I suppose, what do you think drives that? Why do you think that we're wired in that way at the moment?
I think a lot of it is tradition. We've got used to the idea that this is what we do. I mean, for years, human labour was just work sun up to sundown, whether we were working in agricultural spaces and things like that, because we didn't have electric light. So we worked while the light was there, and then that gave us a natural out. And as we started to add ability to work longer hours and in places where humans hadn't been able to work before, we actually saw the work week creep out. So 100 hours was really not uncommon. And then people realized two things. First of all, everybody was dying very young, horribly, with absolutely no time to really enjoy life. But early studies showed that, to be honest, a lot of people didn't work very well when they got tired. And after a certain time, it just wasn't worth pushing people. And we were on track to reduce those working hours until about the 80s, 90s, when things turned around. I think there's a lot of, I think peer pressure plays a big part in it. I think that you want these things, we're saturated with things that we might want to buy. I think there's a lot of that in there. And sometimes it just comes down to the fact that everybody around us is doing it and expects it, so we just kind of go along with it.
So I suppose that raises the question about, is there any way that technology will grant us more time to do those useful and rewarding things, or are we just going to be able to come up with a different kind of a job, or perhaps something more mundane and less kind of value-producing?
Oh, gosh, I hope not. I've got to be honest. We do seem to be quite ingenious about finding ways to suppress our creativity sometimes. What I'm hoping is that as some of the jobs that can be automated are automated, that we do provide more opportunities for people to do those creative and rewarding jobs, because there are lots of people who have the ability to take part in that kind of labour, but it's certainly not universally available. But I think one of the big challenges as we move away from certain types of jobs is making sure that the people who do those jobs now are at the forefront of our mind when we look to creating new types of work. Because every time we've gone through a fairly significant industrial revolution, we have unfortunately tended to leave a lot of people behind, and that's had some really bad impact socially, culturally, and politically.
And we'll touch on that in a moment. I want to speak to one of those case studies, I suppose, where this could be a major threat, and that's in India, where 12.5 million people work in transport, storage and communication industries, and people are worried that driverless cars, something we know is an aspiration of many working in the automotive industry to try and create, that the creation of them might create widespread unemployment for people working in those industries. And, you know, 12.5 million in India is by no means an insignificant number. So will cities abandon technological growth in favour of protecting jobs then? Will there be this clash where people will decide to protect jobs over perhaps increasing convenience?
I think in the short term, we have seen a number of behaviours around that. We've seen protecting human labour when technology could come in and replace it because we didn't have a pathway forward. And this, is for me, is one of the most important issues, by talking about the fact that we really do have some good replacements coming in, but we have to think about the people. This is something that I hope will drive longer-term discussions about retraining and reskilling and making sure that people can find things and ways of living. You know, people have to be able to continue to live. They have to be able to support their families and themselves. And for me, in the short term, I think we're going to see an amount of, no, we won't do that. what I hope that's going to lead to is an acknowledgement that we are going to head down this path. So if we're going to do it, let's try and make this particular branch of the Industrial Revolution work as well as we can, because we are in quite an unusual position in terms of the fact that right now we're not passing the labour onto somebody else in another country, in another place, which we've been doing for years and years. We're actually potentially passing it on to a machine. And that machine doesn't care, doesn't get old, doesn't get drunk. And this is a very different proposition.
Indeed, I can't imagine what drunk robots would get up to if we put them under the influence while working. I just wonder if you spoke about these ideas of not wanting to pursue a certain technology because it might we don't necessarily have the structures in place to protect people who might lose their job as a consequence. Do you think, I suppose, somewhere that people have that discussion is in Australia around our energy sector, that there are a lot of fears that if we move away from producing and mining things like coal, that a lot of people's jobs will be lost and a lot of those people won't have a job to walk into immediately, which obviously has a series of detrimental effects on those people who rely on those jobs. Hey, do you think it's fair to draw those comparisons about in Australia and our own economy?
I think that you can draw those parallels everywhere. I mean, just look at our manufacturing sector, which has already been greatly reduced in human labour through the introduction of machines. And right now, you know, in South Australia, the last cars rolled off the holding line. So our state government has to invest quite heavily in retraining schemes and placement schemes because they don't want to, you know, leave an entire group of people behind. But I think the parallel in energy is there, but it's important to remember that alternative energy generation does in fact create a lot of jobs in terms of producing the kind of things that would come in. And in terms of making that an Australian technology focus that we could then export to the rest of the world as they go through the same process. So in some regards, this is an opportunity to develop a brand new industry. The challenge is, of course, making sure that the people who are coming from one industry and going to another are well supported, and that they're well trained and that they are actually facilitated in that movement. But if I can talk about, you know, just the future of work briefly, they're predicting that a 5-year-old child today is going to have 17 jobs over 5 careers in the future. So the ability to retrain people, to reskill them and to prepare them for whatever the future holds is something we just have to get our head around. So looking at these smaller opportunities, at these smaller positions where we're moving industries from one point to another, is a great place to go in and get this right, because we're going to have to get it right, because the future is not going to be built around do 1 3-year degree and then work for the same company for the next 30 years, or, you know, get one trade and then do something. We're going to see a very different future of work.
And I suppose then this brings it to this idea of a post-work economy and perhaps some of the solutions around it, which is, how can cities support citizens or workers in a post-work economy?
Well, this is one of those areas that people are running experiments all over the place to try and answer this. Universal basic income is one that's often raised, the idea that you can provide support for the things people need to live. And then above and beyond that, if people want to, you know, work and do more things, they will. And all the evidence we have says that, well, in the experiments that have been run, the vast majority say that people who get a UBI still continue to work. They still continue to be productive. They're just not fearful. Now, how we actually pay for that and how we deal with that is an enormous open question, because we currently have issues talking about current welfare schemes, funding the health service. And so it's how we address that is an enormous issue of economic concern. But having said that, we're already spending a very large amount of money in remediation in certain areas. So if we improve spending in housing, for example, we tend to recoup the money that we're spending, which is quite expensive, on dealing with the issues around homelessness. If we invest into schools, then we tend to have to pay less in unemployment. So there are lots of areas where we could potentially be investing more sensibly in order to be gaining more reward.
Indeed, it sounds fascinating to say the least. Nick Faulkner, thank you very much for joining us.
Oh, look, it's a great pleasure. I just wanted to finish by saying I'm actually very optimistic. I think that if we're honest and we think about the people involved, that maybe this time we might actually get it right. I'm certainly very hopeful.
Indeed, I can't help but be hopeful too. I'm an eternal optimist.
Fantastic. Thank you.
Thank you for joining the program.